Hello, and welcome to Sentencing Practice Talk, a podcast for federal sentencing practitioners presented by the U.S. Sentencing Commission. In this episode, my colleagues Lori Baker and Peter Madsen focus in on Chapter 3 of the Guidelines Manual, and in particular, the interplay between an increase at 3C1.1 for obstruction of justice and a reduction at 3E1.1 for an acceptance of responsibility. They cover how they can overlap, how they sometimes don't overlap, and review the various factors that one should consider when making an assessment. Without further ado, here's Lori and Pete.
Hey, Pete.
Hey, good morning, Lori. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Doing pretty good so far today.
So I think we're going to talk a little bit about some Chapter 3 issues. And I've noticed that we've been doing some more training on Chapter 3. Lots of different stuff going on in that chapter that contains our, what I call our generic adjustments, those adjustments that can apply to multiple types of offenses. And you've done a fair amount of training on Chapter 3. And I think through that training, you identified an area that people have had a lot of questions about.
That's true. I think there's two areas, particularly obstruction of justice and acceptance responsibility, and sometimes how they overlap or maybe how they don't overlap. I think that's what creates a little bit of confusion for people sometimes.
Yeah, so let's start by just talking about obstruction at 3C1.1. Tell me a little bit about what that provides.
Right, so you have this two-level increase when somebody, the defendant, obstructs the investigation, the prosecution, or the sentencing of the instant offense of construction. Well, offense of conviction, right? So, like, say they're threatening or they're intimidating a co-defendant or a witness. Maybe they're committing perjury, falsifying documents, counterfeiting documents, or maybe in some of those individuals actually escape before trial, or maybe they fail to appear for that matter. That's the kind of conduct we're talking about.
So our application notes can be helpful in trying to figure out if you have obstructive conduct or not. We have an application note that talks about conduct that ordinarily could be considered for this increase. And then we have another one that talks about examples of conduct that wouldn't normally qualify for the enhancement, such as somebody who lies when they're arrested, which, you know, happens fairly regularly because people are scared or whatever. So some of those more minor matters would not qualify for the obstruction increase. Right. So once people kind of get over that hurdle of figuring out if obstruction applies, then they have to assess acceptance of responsibility at 3E1.1. So tell us what how acceptance works.
Right. So generally speaking, if a defendant clearly demonstrates acceptance responsibility for the offense, they get a two-level decrease. They can earn a third level off if the offense level is greater than 16 and the government files that motion saying, you know, the defendant assisted in the investigation or the prosecution of his own misconduct by providing them timely notifying them of their intent to plead guilty. So
I think where people really struggle is when both of these things might apply. There might be some obstructive conduct, and then the person seemingly would qualify for acceptance. But there's kind of an inconsistency there, right? If you obstruct justice, probably is not an indication that you've accepted responsibility. And we do have an application note that talks about that, that talks about how those two things can be inconsistent. And if you have obstruction, you ordinarily would not have acceptance. But that's not necessarily always the case. People assume that if you have one, you can't have the other. But I think that there are a lot of factors to consider here.
I think that's an understatement. There are a ton of factors. And I think you mentioned about the first part of the application note in 3E1.1. It's application note 4. The last sentence there actually specifies that in extraordinary cases, there may be a case when the adjustment applies under both 3C1.1 and 3E1.1. So they potentially get an obstruction increase, but then get the decrease for acceptance responsibility. And I think that's where the confusion sometimes comes in. Like, how do we manage these two somewhat competing adjustments.
Yeah, and then we use that word extraordinary cases. But, you know, we don't really provide a definition of what extraordinary means or provide too much guidance on how to, you know, parse this out. So let's talk about some situations. Give me a situation where you would have obstructive conduct and the obstruction of justice enhancement applies, and this person clearly has not demonstrated acceptance of responsibility.
Right. So I think there are certain instances where people obstruct during the investigation or early on in the investigation, maybe telling a friend or a sister, hey, don't cooperate with the feds, don't talk to them about anything. However, somewhere down the line, they see the light at the end of the tunnel and decide to plead guilty. They now are providing full cooperation, and they're now telling their friend or maybe their sibling, hey, it's okay now, cooperate, tell them everything you know. So you clearly have obstructive conduct at the investigation aspect. They've now pled guilty, and now it appears as though they're actually accepting responsibility and not doing anything that's obstructive any longer, I guess you can say.
So that's an example of, yep, this person obstructed, but then later kind of turned things around and has clearly demonstrated acceptance. But give me an example of someone's obstructed and they don't qualify for acceptance, kind of the opposite of what you just gave me.
So, Lori, that is a really good question. I think there are certain instances where defendants have pled guilty. For instance, they pled guilty to a drug trafficking crime. They're on bond. They're awaiting sentencing. However, they start selling drugs again. They start hanging out with the wrong crowd and ultimately end up getting themselves arrested for more criminal activity, that being selling drugs. So they pled guilty. You presumably would accept responsibility. However, there's ongoing criminal activity after they plead guilty. That conduct is certainly not consistent with the acceptance responsibility. And they're also probably going to get obstruction of justice because that conduct obviously obstructed the investigation, prosecution, or sentencing of that instant offense.
So I think one of the differences in the two examples that you just gave are kind of pre-plea and post-plea behavior, and those can be factors in both of these Chapter 3 adjustments, obstruction of justice and acceptance. When did the conduct occur? So in the first example that you gave us, maybe somebody did something obstructive way back in the beginning and then has turned a corner, pled guilty, done all the right things, moving forward to fully accept responsibility. In that case, you might get obstruction and acceptance, but you plead guilty and then you end up obstructing, probably not going to qualify for acceptance at that point.
Right. You bring up a good point because I think a lot of times some of that obstructive conduct occurs prior to the guilty plea, right? They're trying to avoid, you know, either being convicted or they're trying to avoid investigators finding evidence that would substantiate their criminal activity. So whether it's, you know, enticement of a minor or a child pornography type case where they're deleting their phone or they're talking to the victim to say, delete everything, or even in a fraud case where they're like throwing computers away, wiping hard drives, all that conduct occurs pre-plea. Once they enter that guilty plea, now we're looking at what kind of conduct are they doing post-plea? Are there ongoing attempts to obstruct justice, or what is that length of period post-plea that indicates that they truly have accepted responsibility and accepted responsibility for the offense?
Yeah, so clearly these can be difficult decisions to make. So I guess the guidance generally is, even though we have this application note that says, you know, ordinarily someone who obstructs justice wouldn't be eligible for acceptance of responsibility other than those extraordinary cases, they really are fact-specific, case-by-case decisions. So don't automatically disqualify somebody from acceptance. Make sure you're looking at all of those factors, because there are a fair number of cases where both of these would apply. And actually, Pete, when you and I were talking about preparing for this podcast, we get a lot of questions about acceptance of responsibility generally, aside from the obstruction, which also leads to a similar analysis. Maybe somebody has pled guilty to a certain number of counts and went to trial on other counts. What do you do there? You've got kind of inconsistent application issues. So there's a lot of times with acceptance where our guidance to people is, you know, it's kind of a balancing act. You have to look at what factors weigh in favor of acceptance, what factors weigh against, and make your decision, you know, based on that preponderance standard. So this kind of works the same way with obstruction and acceptance. Weigh it all out, you know, do the balancing, look at the factors and see where you land. And as always, call us on the helpline if you want to talk it through. Sometimes just talking to somebody helps you to come to your decision.
I think that's a good point. Submitting your helpline question or calling and leaving a message. These are questions that don't have easy answers. This is not, well, he did this pre-plea, he did this post-plea. Here's, I'm going to check a box and call it good. I mean, they really do have to walk through the analysis for both Chapter 3 obstruction and the Chapter 3 for acceptance responsibility. And certainly being able to talk to somebody about it and walk through some of the options certainly would be helpful.
Yeah, and I think that's key too. We may not be able to give you the black and white answer to your question because, of course, we can't know all the ins and outs of the investigation or the situation, but we can talk through these factors and help you come to your decision on both of these matters. All right. Thank you, Peter.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Sentencing Practice Talk. Be sure to subscribe if you haven't already to the podcast on iTunes or Spotify to stay up to date. The Commission has just added a virtual training session on Chapter 3 adjustments. If you'd like to review that, you can visit us at ussc.gov. Please be advised that the information provided by Commission staff is offered to assist in understanding and applying the sentencing guidelines. The information does not necessarily represent the official position of the Commission, should not be considered definitive, and is not binding upon the Commission, court, or the parties in any case. This episode was produced and published at taxpayer expense. That's all for now. Thanks for listening.